This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Tuesday, October 8th. I'm John Wanamaker. New information shows the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis debated for nearly a decade what to do about pornography found on a priest's computer. Madeline Barron reports.
The documents detail how top church officials knew of the priest's pornography and the potential for some of it being child pornography and did not tell police. Former Archdiocese employee Jennifer Hasselberger provided the documents to the St. Paul Police Department earlier this year. They include a draft of a letter to the Vatican in which Archbishop John Neinstedt worried about possible criminal prosecution of himself and the Archdiocese for keeping the images since 2004. Other documents show that a private investigator classified many of the images as, quote, borderline illegal. Police did not learn of the images until this year, when Hasselberger called the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Islamic Center of St. Cloud withdrew its application for a mosque development last night at a city council meeting that drew 500 people. Mosque supporters pulled the proposal before a final vote after council member comments made it clear there was not support for a needed zoning change. Center leaders say they'll revise the mosque plan to address traffic concerns. The 9.5-acre project would have included a mosque, classrooms, and a gym, all built in phases on a patch of vacant land on Clearwater Road. The plan withdrawn last night already went through a lengthy approval process at St. Cloud's Planning Commission, but now St. Cloud City staff say any new proposal from the Islamic Center would need to start that process again from the beginning. A Twin Cities railroad company is disputing a new freight rail fix proposed for the Southwest Light Rail project. Laura Ewan has more.
The alternative came in the form of a letter sent Friday to key officials involved with Southwest LRT. The letter, written by Phil Qualley of the United Transportation Union, said a current $200 million proposal to reroute existing freight traffic from a stretch in Minneapolis to St. Louis Park was overreaching. Qualley said his group, which represents railroad workers, is trying to inform decision makers that there is another path that could cost less. It's about 3/4 of a mile north of the current proposal. But in an email to key state lawmakers over the weekend, Twin Cities and Western Railroad President Mark Wagner pointed out what he considered two significant flaws with the union's proposed route. Wagner added that the option is not the holy grail that officials had been looking for.
That's reporter Laura Ewan. Critics of Minnesota's estate tax say it could drive wealthy residents to other states that don't tax assets passed on to children and other heirs. But as Minnesota Public Radio's Martin Moylan reports, the tax can also bite middle-class Minnesotans who don't feel like millionaires, but who could be, at least in the eyes of the law.
Minnesota's estate tax is projected to raise about $170 million a year. It's a small fraction of state revenue and hits a small percentage of residents, typically among the most affluent. But middle-class couples can be making an expensive mistake if they assume the tax can't possibly apply to them.
The estate tax at the Minnesota level kicks in for estates over $1 million, and it's not very difficult for a middle-class family to reach that threshold.
Scott Nelson is an attorney and chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Probate and Trust Council. He says many people don't realize the range of assets tax law considers part of an estate, life insurance proceeds, for instance.
When you add in the death benefit on life insurance and the retirement accounts and the equity in the home, you know, you can easily get to the $1 million threshold.
While the vast majority of residents don't trigger Minnesota's estate tax, many may be closer to the threshold than they realize. Say a husband dies with $400,000 in life insurance, perhaps another $400,000 in retirement savings. With that money added to the surviving spouse's assets, the surviving spouse may be closing in on millionaire status. No tax problem yet, but there could be one when the husband's widow dies. Shannon Enright is a Stillwater estate planning attorney.
When the first spouse dies, everything can pass to the surviving spouse free of estate tax. But upon the second death, that's where couples run into trouble.
The problem is in passing everything to their surviving spouse and leaving that person with an estate that can continue growing to more than $1 million. Estates worth more than $1 million generally end up getting taxed by the state at rates of 10 to 15%. Estate analyst estimates the hit on an estate estate of $1.3 million, for instance, would probably be in the range of $40,000 to $50,000. But Enright says a will or other estate planning instrument can take advantage of the fact that a $1 million exemption is available to each spouse.
By putting a plan in place before that first spouse dies, you can make sure that both $1 million exemption amounts get used. So you essentially have $2 million as a couple instead of $1 million.
Enright says a trust that reduces or even eliminates estate taxes can be included in a will or other estate planning tool. The whole package would probably cost a few thousand dollars in legal fees, but Enright says that's a bargain compared to paying estate taxes. Minnesota recently added provisions designed to tax parts of an estate given away in someone's final 3 years of life. In a recent appearance on NPR's Daily Circuit Show, House Tax Committee Chair Ann Lencheski defended the move as making the wealthy pay their fair share.
This is a progressive tax based on the ability to pay.
But former Republican state legislator King Banyan and other estate tax critics say Minnesota is adding to the tax when Congress is making it easier to escape the federal estate tax.
The real issue here is increasing complexity and compliance costs takes people away from doing the things that actually create wealth for society.
But as long as lawyers can help clients avoid taxes, they'll inevitably have a lively business doing that. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Twin Cities-based Medtronic came out on the wrong end of a potentially costly decision from the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday. Medtronic had appealed an adverse judgment in a patent infringement lawsuit, but the court refused to take up the matter. That could cost the medical device maker about $250 million in damages awarded to Edwards Life Sciences. The dispute involves devices that repair aortic valves without open-heart surgery. Bloomberg News reports the U.S. market for such devices could reach $2.5 billion. Morningstar analyst Debbie Wong says Medtronic will suffer greatly if the ruling locks the company out of the U.S. market for the aortic valve technology.
That could easily set them back another 3 to 4 years in getting a competitive product into the U.S. market. And by that point, they might be third to market because I expect that St. Jude will enter somewhere around 2016.
Medtronic said it doesn't expect any impact on domestic aortic valve clinical trials. Currently, the company only makes and sells the disputed products outside the U.S. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. State education officials say their alternative to the federal No Child Left Behind program has passed its first test. Last week, the state released rankings that showed 27 schools improved enough to be moved from the bottom of the list. Supporters credit a system that offers more help and fewer penalties for struggling schools, but critics worry schools are being let off the hook before real improvement is shown. Tim Post has more.
There was good news for several Minnesota schools in the second year of statewide rankings under the Multiple Measurement Ratings, or MMR. The system gives every school in the state a percentage score based on student test scores, academic growth, graduation rates, and how well schools are closing the academic gap between white students and students of color. It's the alternative system state officials pitched to get out of No Child Left Behind, which ranked schools only on test scores and punished so-called failing schools. St. Paul's Humboldt High School, with 1,200 students in grades 6 through 12, moved up and out of the bottom category of struggling schools in the latest rankings. Principal Mike Sadomka says that's due to hard work by the school's students and staff.
All of our students have done better on the MCA tests. It also means that we have excelled at exceeding the achievement gap reduction, and it also means that we have excelled at increasing our graduation rate.
Last year, Humboldt found itself in the bottom 5% in terms of overall performance, and the state labeled it a priority school. That required the school to work with the state to develop an improvement plan. The state also provided training for teachers. Sadomka says that was key to the school's upward movement in the MMR rankings.
It is very refreshing not to have the label or the stigma of really being a priority school, but we're not going to rest on our laurels. We're still going to move forward, and we recognize there's areas that we can still grow and improve.
Sadomka hopes in coming years his school can increase student test scores and graduation rates enough to qualify for a new label, Reward School, one of the top designations in the state's MMR system. In all, 27 schools improved their ranking enough to shed the priority or focus label at the bottom of the ratings. Minnesota education officials credit the help schools receive from Centers of Educational Excellence. The centers, located around the state, provide struggling schools with assistance, starting with training for principals and other school leaders. The help includes a state-approved school improvement plan that generally lays out strategies to raise student test scores and graduation rates. Tony Cox, director of the state's Northern Center of Excellence in Thief River Falls, says the state also sends in experts to help teachers.
Perhaps one of our specialists is actually in a classroom modeling a teaching strategy, team teaching with a teacher, or coaching a classroom teacher.
Cox says each school has unique challenges, and some need more time and support to move up the rankings. Despite improvement, there are still 25 Minnesota schools considered priority schools. 74 are focus schools, a designation that specifically targets schools with wide achievement gaps. Some critics of the school ranking system worry the state is moving schools out of the lowest categories before they're ready. Jim Bartholomew, educational policy director at the Minnesota Business Partnership, says the system puts more weight on improvement in scores than how good those scores are. Bartholomew says schools that show improvement in scores can still have low math, science, and reading proficiency rates among students of color.
If you extrapolate where the low-income students or African-American or Hispanic kids are performing today, and you look at the annual growth that they've been making to get off the list, it would take sometimes decades before those students would equal today's white student performance.
State education officials maintain the multiple measurement rating system is a better way to rank schools and help schools than one based purely on test scores. And they say when a school moves out of the lowest category in the ranking, state support for the school doesn't end. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota could know by the end of the week if it has made the shortlist to host the Super Bowl in 2018. Although the Super Bowl is traditionally held in warmer locations, this season's game will be outdoors in February in New Jersey. Vikings spokesman Lester Bagley says that's an indication that the NFL will consider Minnesota.
The reason they're delivering a Super Bowl there is because they delivered a stadium there, and it's similar to Indianapolis, to Dallas, to Detroit, all communities that stepped up and helped fund a new stadium. And part of the selection criteria for the NFL is which communities stepped up to solve stadium problems, and there's no doubt that Minnesota stepped up.
Minneapolis hosted the 1992 Super Bowl. The Vikings' new stadium is scheduled to open in 2016. Blood transfusions save lives, and if you need one, there's no question you should get one. But a lot of patients get transfusions who probably don't need them, and that can be harmful because the procedure increases your risk of infection and other medical complications. Research suggests doctors can get better results by using donor blood less often in patients who are medically stable. The findings have spurred some Minnesota hospitals to tighten their transfusion guidelines. It's a big change in how some physicians practice medicine, and it required their cooperation to be successful. As Lorna Benson reports, one hospital system decided its project rollout was worth more than a memo.
A little more than a year ago, Alina Health System unveiled new transfusion guidelines. The half dozen changes did appear in a one-page memo, but Alina's transfusion team wanted their message to be much more memorable. Like a popular television show, you just can't miss. So they took inspiration from Law and Order and recorded a DVD parody called The Blood Police.
Hello, Dr. Martini.
Dr. Martini, this is Renee. I'm taking care of Mrs. Olson.
In the episode called The Case of Too Much Blood, a doctor and nurse decide that a patient who's just had knee surgery needs donor blood based on her low hemoglobin reading. Hemoglobin levels reflect the oxygen-carrying capacity of a patient's blood. As they walk toward the patient's room, an officer with the blood police, who looks a bit like actor Kevin Spacey, pulls the doctor and nurse aside and grills them about their plan to give the patient 2 units of red blood cells.
Does your patient have any symptoms, or is red your favorite color?
In keeping with the Law and Order vibe, the blood cop doesn't show much mercy when he hears that the doctor and nurse ordered the blood based on the patient's test result alone, rather than an in-person assessment of her condition.
Do you think that this blood acts like her own blood?
Probably not, but it's better than being anemic.
This has been in the refrigerator for 21 days. Do you know what a red blood cell looks like after 21 days in the refrigerator?
The message of the DVD is that, contrary to popular wisdom, donated red cells are a poor substitute for a patient's own blood. Sure, the cells save lives when patients suffer heavy bleeding, but up to 25% of red blood cells are dead by the time they're transfused into patients. The body recognizes those dead cell fragments and orders the immune system to clean them up, making the body less able to fight infections. Allina anesthesiologist Josh Martini is the well-meaning doctor in the video. He says blood transfusion thinking has evolved a lot since he received his medical training.
I mean, I was told in medical school, you know, you don't bother giving one unit. You should just give two if you're going to give any.
Today, the mantra is changing to why give two when one will do. Since Allina tightened its transfusion guidelines in 2012, the average number of blood units transfused to patients in the health system has dropped by 38%. A similar effort at Regions Hospital in St. Paul has also reduced transfusions. 2 years ago, 20% of joint surgery patients at Regions received donor blood. Now just 5% get a transfusion. Orthopedic surgeon Gavin Pittman says the hospital is still compiling data from its transfusion project, but he says it appears that Regions' infection rate dropped during the same time period, and he doesn't think it's a coincidence.
We also have noted typically shorter length of stay, improved risk of medical complications such as pneumonias or congestive heart failure.
It's not known how many Minnesota hospitals have launched projects to reduce blood transfusions. The American Red Cross North Central Region says it's collaborating with several large hospitals in the metro area and a few smaller ones in greater Minnesota. Medical Director David Mayer says the science supporting a more conservative transfusion approach has been around for more than a decade, but the message is still new to many.
This has really just started really catching on across the country. And so we've kind of been flying this banner for years, but in the past few, we've really seen a dramatic change.
The new transfusion goals have had the added benefit of conserving the blood supply, which is a limited resource. And that's prompted some health systems to look at what else they can do to save blood. Mayo Clinic in Rochester transfuses more blood each year than some Western states. Any weak link in its blood donation system can result in a lot of waste. Mayo discovered that it was discarding a lot of blood because the portable coolers in its operating rooms could only chill blood packets effectively for about 4 hours. So Mayo found new coolers that stay cold for 18 hours. Surgeon Robert Sima says that's long enough to get through most surgeries.
We were wasting, quote unquote, because we weren't using it, almost $500,000 to $600,000 a year of blood. That's gone down to almost zero.
There are signs that new transfusion limits and blood conservation efforts may be relieving pressure on the nation's blood supply. AABB, formerly known as the American Association of Blood Banks, says red cell transfusions have fallen by about 8% since 2008. That transfusion trend may have averted a blood supply crisis, because during the same time period, blood donations in the U.S. fell 9%.
That's reporter Lorna Benson. And if you're a diver or just a Great Lakes historian or you like shipwrecks, you're going to like this next story. Here's All Things Considered host Tom Cran.
It has been a big summer for Jerry Eliason and his team of shipwreck hunters on Lake Superior. Back in May, they located the Henry B. Smith, a long-sought ore freighter that was caught in a storm 100 years ago. Now this weekend, we got word they found another freighter under the waves. This one may be the deepest known shipwreck on Lake Superior. It's called the Scotia Dock, and it was carrying a load of wheat from Thunder Bay when it collided with another ship in heavy fog in 1953. Unlike the Henry B. Smith, most of the crew of the Scotia Dock survived the wreck, but the ship itself was lost to the lake until a few weeks ago when Eliason and his fellow searchers captured it on video. So Jerry Eliason joins me again on the phone from Duluth. Congratulations again.
Oh, yeah, thanks a lot.
So put this on the map for us. Where exactly did you find this freighter, the Scotia Dock?
I'm not permitted to say exactly in terms of lat-long coordinates. Searching for and documenting shipwrecks previously undiscovered in Canada requires a permit. And one of the conditions of the permit is that we don't reveal the precise location. So in terms of general part of the world, it's 3 miles south-southeast of Trowbridge Island.
Can you tell when you look at the video, and I was looking at it, do you learn more about how it went down or what happened to it?
Well, each sinking is unique, and we have never seen one that went down in quite this depth of water before. We believe that it is the deepest shipwreck ever discovered in the Great Lakes. The previous deepest one was the Isaac Jenkins that went down at Lake Ontario at a depth of 750 feet. So just seeing that it made it all the way to the bottom as intact as it did was a real pleasure.
The Scotia Dock, tell us about this ship. You know, put it in perspective for us. What shape is it in and how big was it, all of that?
It was 425 feet long, which would be small by today's 1,000-footer standards, but it was state-of-the-art in the early 1900s. It appears to have sunk stern first. There's a lot of damage at the stern, but the bow is reasonably intact. The wheelhouse itself did lift off, but that's laying just in front of the tip of the bow.
Now, tell us about the circumstances that it perished under.
Well, it was in a June fog in 1953. Not only was it foggy, but it was windy. Usually that doesn't happen, but to stay out of the worst of the wind, it decided to follow a more northerly route than normal. So it passed across in front of the inbound shipping lane to Thunder Bay. The surprising thing is that both ships had radar, but they still managed to run into each other. And there was really no good reason that they shouldn't have gotten on their radio telephones, which they had, and decided how they were going to pass each other.
Now, I want to ask about why it is you do this. A lot of people hear this, and they think maybe it's treasure hunting. You're going to try to bring some of this ship back up, but that's not what's behind it, is it?
No, not at all. Well, I think it's twofold. One is just writing the final chapter in that ship's history. That's a part of it. And then just solving the mystery the way it is. You always try to imagine what kind of condition it's going to be. Sometimes you're disappointed. Sometimes you're ecstatic about how good it is. I've never saw a ship underwater with so much white paint on it. That's really amazing on this one, how the paint has just stayed on it.
Jerry Eliason is part of a team of shipwreck hunters that found two big wrecks this summer on Lake Superior, the latest, the Canadian freighter, the Scotia Dock, that went down in heavy fog in 1953 after a collision with another ship.
That's the NPR News update for Tuesday, October 8th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.